Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley. Supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Florida State University, ranked in the top 20 among national public universities in the latest U.S. News & World Report. FSU specialty license plates support scholarships for deserving students. More on FSU specialty plates is at fsu.edu/mytag. Rambana & Ritchie, immigration attorneys concentrating on complex immigration across the nation from Florida's capital and their mobile office. Self-sponsored green cards, I-9 compliance, and deportation defense. Rambana & Ritchie, on the web at rambana.com. And from the Florida AFL-CIO, representing over 1 million union members, retirees, and their families, committed to building a better future for all Floridians by promoting healthy communities, economic justice, and dignity in the workplace. Online at flaflcio.org. From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
Democrats, election supervisors, and voting rights groups join in opposition to Florida's proposed election law changes, but Republicans in the legislature are forging ahead anyway.
Yeah, you're going to do what you're going to do anyway. So I do not support this. I believe it's egregious.
Also tonight, lots of politicians have been grousing about social media censorship, but a new survey suggests a lot of average folks in Florida don't like those restrictions very much either.
Nothing's been done in Washington, which has left it to states like Florida to figure out what are the actions that we can take.
We'll also get the latest on the debate over who should pay for certain kinds of ambulance rides in Florida, as well as a bill to ban what are called disability abortions. I'm Tom Flanagan. It's the midpoint of week 7 in session. This is Capitol Report. Florida's Senate Rules Committee is preparing to scale down a proposal that would have done away with ballot drop boxes in the name of election reform. Lynn Hatter reports despite the change, the plan is still under fire from Democrats and voting rights groups who say the rest of the bill still makes it harder for Floridians to vote.
Republican Senator Dennis Baxley's bill is not so much a response to Florida's elections, which went largely problem-free during the last cycle, but to what he describes as issues in other states and future problems. Here's Baxley responding to questions by Democratic Senate Minority Leader Gary Farmer.
I'm not trying to present a case that there's a problem. I'm presenting a case that we can prevent ever having a problem.
Okay, so again, that's a no. You're not aware of any specific instance. It's just your fear of tampering that's driving this legislation.
Sir, I'm not afraid of anything, but I want the most legitimate process we can deliver. And this is the way I think we should do it.
For more than 2 hours Wednesday, Baxley battled amendments to his bill and defended it against accusations that the proposal would disenfranchise voters. The 2020 election cycle saw a surge in overall voter participation, fueled largely by more Black voters casting ballots. Democratic Senator Randolph Bracey worries the change will result in fewer people being able to vote.
Everyone signs up electronically to vote now. Everyone does it that way. And now if we're going to eliminate all those people from being able to vote that have signed up electronically, I've never seen anything like this, and I can't believe that we're sitting here debating this. But as Brian Pitts would say, you're going to do what you're going to do anyway. So I do not support this. I believe it's egregious. I'm a no.
The newest iteration of Baxley's bill allows supervisors to use ballot drop boxes only during early voting. They would not be available after hours. The measure calls for additional verification for people picking up ballots for others and expands the number of people who can directly observe ballot verification, allowing people to be in, quote, very close proximity to canvassers, but not defining what very close is. Mark Early is Leon County Supervisor of Elections and Vice President of the Statewide Association. He's especially concerned about proposed changes to how signatures are verified.
That potentially is going to greatly disrupt our ability to validate vote-by-mail ballots. I think the likelihood of it disenfranchising voters.
Thank you for the response.
That's Committee Chairwoman Kathleen Passidomo. The proposal places limitations on what can be given to voters standing in line and who can give it to them. There is an exemption for elections volunteers or office employees. While most speakers on the bill oppose it, Helena Sims is an outlier.
We shouldn't compromise our election process in the name of convenience. I support Representative Baxley's bill because it helps make vote by mail more secure and on a par with in-person voting.
While a majority of amendments to the bill failed, a few did get through, among those an effort to prevent a bogus candidate from spoiling races. I'm Lynn Hatter.
Going after social media platforms for censorship has been a priority in Florida's Republican-dominated legislature this session. Several bills addressing the issue have been introduced, with at least a couple advancing. Governor Ron DeSantis has expressed support for the measures, which lawmakers filed after Twitter disabled President Donald Trump's account. Valerie Crowder reports a recent survey shows Floridians mostly support the efforts to rein in the power of social media companies in the marketplace.
Proposed legislation moving through both chambers would require social media companies to notify users within 30 days of disabling their accounts, an action often referred to as deplatforming. It would also allow the Florida Elections Commission to fine those companies up to $100,000 a day for censoring political candidates or news outlets. During a call with reporters Wednesday, Republican State Senator Ray Rodriguez said lawmakers want to ensure the legislation would hold up in court. He says the bill could evolve as it moves through the committee process.
Is what we have seen is that these social media platforms claim to be a platform, so they're not subject to being held liable for anything that's put out there, but they're actually determining what will and will not be on their platform. So they've taken on the role of the publisher, but shirked the responsibility that comes with being a publisher. And that's an untenable situation.
The Federal Telecommunications Act of 1996 makes it harder for people to sue internet platforms than traditional news publishers. Rodriguez says that's become a problem with the rise of social media platforms like Facebook and Twitter.
Where we are today is what we have seen is that these social media platforms claim to be a platform, so they're not subject to being held liable for anything that's put out there, but they're actually determining what will and will not be on their platform. So they've taken on the role of the publisher, but shirked the responsibility that comes with being a publisher. And that's an untenable situation.
State legislators on both sides of the aisle have suggested federal lawmakers are better positioned to rein in social media censorship. Rodriguez agrees.
The best case scenario to solve this is if the U.S. Congress would go back into that 1996 Internet Act, look at Section 230, and make some further clarifications in federal law, that would solve this altogether. The problem is nothing's been done in Washington, which has left it up to states like Florida to figure out what are the actions that we can take to protect our consumers.
More than half of Floridians recently surveyed in a Mason-Dixon poll expressed support for stopping social media companies from censoring and deplatforming users. The poll surveyed a random sampling of 625 registered voters via telephone, with a margin of error at plus or minus 4 percentage points. 66% of respondents reported they feel Facebook has too much power in the marketplace, and 62% said the same about Twitter. The South Florida Hispanic Chamber of Commerce sponsored the survey. Founder Lily Lopez says the chamber is nonpartisan but supports the bill because social media censorship threatens small businesses' ability to express themselves freely online. She says she's heard from people who've had posts removed and they're not sure why or how to fix it.
We support our businesses. And my thing is that they're supposed to be free and open and to be able to write or share their experiences. And nobody's insulting anybody. Nobody's doing anything. There's no type of threat. And just something simple and you're shut down. Why is that happening? So that is really our main concern because we are non-political.
This isn't the first time Florida state lawmakers have gone after social media companies for censorship. In 2019, a bill was introduced that would have made it easier for people to sue platforms for removing content deemed hate speech. The bills under consideration now were filed days after Twitter disabled former President Donald Trump's account over concerns his tweets could incite more violence following the storming of the U.S. Capitol. The Senate version is still moving through committee. The House version is getting another reading in the full chamber. I'm Valerie Crowder.
An effort to overturn a 2020 vote in Key West that limited cruise ship operations is ready to go before the full Florida Senate. The Senate Rules Committee today approved the measure, which would apply to municipal-run ports in Key West, Pensacola, Panama City, and St. Petersburg, and prohibit past and future local referendums that affect cruise ship operations. Of the municipal-run ports, only Key West has cruise ship operations, though negotiations are underway to bring cruise ships to Panama City. Senator Jim Boyd is the bill sponsor.
There is no scientifically based study that I've seen that's true science that suggests the reefs are being destroyed.
Democrats, including Senator Gary Farmer, though, criticized the proposal because it would preempt the local law.
It's really another level of preemption when we're going against a vote that was put to a referendum.
The House version of the bill has drawn support from two subcommittees and needs approval from the Commerce Committee before it could go to the full House. Still to come on Capitol Report, lawmakers are working to clarify how non-emergency medical transportation for people who get benefits from both Medicare and Medicaid should be paid for.
What is really an already earned benefit that's already paid for, we just a lot faster figure out who actually writes the check.
Robbie Gaffney speaks with a disability rights advocate about a bill that would ban what are called disability abortions.
The problem with the bill is that it doesn't do anything to improve the quality of life for people with disabilities.
And even though catastrophe was narrowly averted when an abandoned phosphate mine's holding pond threatened to inundate nearby neighborhoods, the basic problem still has Florida officials flummoxed.
The object would be to come back next year and have a fully funded plan.
A measure that would make sure ambulances get reimbursed after giving non-emergency rides to people covered by both Medicaid and Medicare is expected to be at the governor's desk soon. We get more on that story from Regan McCarthy.
Medicaid is a state and federal government program that provides health care coverage for low-income residents. Medicare is a federal health insurance program for seniors. In some cases, a person could be eligible for both. Then Medicare would pay for acute care and Medicaid would pay for premiums and copays. For example, under current law, Medicaid should cover all the deductibles and coinsurance for Medicare emergency transportation services provided by ambulances. But Doral Republican Senator Ana Maria Rodriguez says there's a problem.
Some Medicare non-emergency ambulance transportation services are not being appropriately reimbursed based on a recent reinterpretation of the authorizing Medicaid payment statute.
While Florida law requires Medicaid to pay deductibles and coinsurance for Medicare emergency transportation services, Rodriguez says the law does not make it clear how expenses for non-emergency transportation via ambulance is reimbursed. Tampa Democratic Senator Janet Cruz says that's a problem because it can leave ambulance companies in the lurch. And she says that's a big deal for some of the small businesses that provide medical transportation.
Because the large ambulance companies make sure they get paid. They have a battalion of attorneys that will fight for those copays and those deductibles. But it's the smaller independent ambulance companies that don't have, they don't have the money or the legal services to fight, and they're the ones that get shorted.
Rodriguez has a bill she says will address that by clarifying how reimbursement should work.
Senate Bill 348 updates Statute 409.908 to remove the distinction between Medicare emergency and non-emergency transportation services provided by ambulances for Medicaid reimbursement purposes.
And Lake Mary Republican Senator Jason Brodeur says that makes sense. He says this isn't something new. These are payments that should be made, and Rodriguez's bill makes the process clearer and smoother.
The money was always due for these folks. It's part of their benefits. It's part of the entitlement. And payers are getting wrapped around the axle as to who should be responsible for it. And Senator Cruz said, the little guys get caught up in this. They're due the money. It's part of their benefit. And that the finger pointing has got to stop. And so thank you for the codification of what is really an already earned benefit that's already paid for. We just a lot faster figure out who actually writes the check.
I'm Regan McCarthy.
Florida lawmakers are advancing a bill that would ban a physician from aborting a woman's pregnancy if that physician believes the woman is ending her pregnancy because of a prenatal diagnosis of a disability. Robbie Gaffney spoke about the proposed measure with a disability rights advocate.
Olivia Babis, you're with Disability Rights Florida. Let's begin with how the bill defines disability. It says, disability is any disease, defect, or disorder that is genetically inherited, including a physical disability, mental or intellectual disability, physical disfigurement, and more. Is that how your organization would define a disability?
No. I mean, to use defect in a bill, I think, is a little problematic. But what's really lost in the bill is the social construct. Disability. Disability isn't based strictly on pathology. So you may have someone with a diagnosis of Down syndrome. Not everyone's Down syndrome looks the same. So you may have someone with Down syndrome that is nonverbal. You may have someone with Down syndrome, and there are people with Down syndrome that have gone to college, that have earned PhDs, that are college professors. So we really can't determine just based on pathology to what degree a diagnosis or an impairment is really going to disable someone. It really is determined more by the social construct, kind of the environment and the geography where they were born and where they were raised and the resources and services they had access to.
So the bill's sponsor has said decisions should not be made to end a pregnancy based on disability. What do you make of that?
Abortion is a really complicated issue for the disability community. People with disabilities, of course, were killed in concentration camps in Germany. We've had instances of infanticide in the United States, which is where doctors have withheld medical treatment from babies born with disabilities. So there is sensitivity to that. But on the other side of this, people with disabilities have also been denied body autonomy. So we had forced sterilization in the United States and forced institutionalization. Myself as a woman with a disability, I can say that I've had doctors when I was in my early 20s, offer to perform sterilization procedures, just assuming I didn't want to have kids because I was a person with a disability. We don't often have what we refer to as the dignity of risk in the disability community. So say you wanted to go horseback riding. You could sign a waiver. They would let you get on a horse. Somebody would give you lessons. You could go. I have to get a permission slip from my doctor. And my disability isn't something that is treated. It's just a characteristic about me. So my doctor who treats me for the flu or gives me vaccines occasionally knows nothing about my day-to-day life and my activities. Yet this is the person I have to go to who gets to make decisions on what risks I get to take with my body. So in that regard, it really is a complicated decision for people with disabilities. And it really is a divisive issue within the disability community. But the problem with the bill is that it doesn't do anything to improve the quality of life for people with disabilities.
So what would this bill need to do in order to help people with disabilities?
We base our programs that are designed to assist people on antiquated ideas and misconceptions about disability. When Medicaid was set up, it was thought that, most people with disabilities at that point were in institutional care. So it was assumed that if you had a disability, you couldn't work. So if you could work, you didn't need access to these programs. In the last 40, 50 years, we've learned that's absolutely not the case, that even people with what are considered pretty extensive disabilities can work when they're given the right resources. So what we really need to be focusing on is kind of an overhaul and major reforms of these systems and how they operate to allow people to enter the workforce without losing their health care and their personal care supports, to integrate them. And like I said, that would be more cost efficient. We're getting them out of institutional care. They're able to live on their own. It's not as stressful on their families. You're not going to have to worry about, you know, if you get a fetal diagnosis of Down syndrome, when you find out you're pregnant, you're not going to have that fear then of, oh my God, is my child going to be 6 years old and still living at home with me when I'm 80 or 90? Because you know that child's going to have access to the supports and resources they need to have quality of life and to be as independent or interdependent as they can be.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for speaking with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you. You're welcome.
That was Capitol reporter Robbie Gaffney speaking with Disability Rights Florida advocate Olivia Babbis. Another busy day facing lawmakers tomorrow as we hear from Gina Jordan.
Here's a look at what's coming up in the Florida legislature. Amid a booming real estate market, lawmakers are considering more restrictions on impact fees. Local governments say those fees are needed to help keep up with growth. Proposed legislation puts limits on impact fee increases and defines the types of infrastructure projects that can be funded. The maximum state unemployment benefit may be increased to $375 a week. That's $100 more than the current rate. The pandemic led to widespread calls for increasing the state's maximum amount, which is among the lowest in the nation. Changes are proposed to the health education curriculum for public schools. In part, legislation would require instruction about preventing child sexual abuse, exploitation, and human trafficking. Two-thirds of the vote may soon be needed to approve constitutional amendments. That's up from the current threshold of 60% of voters. If approved by lawmakers, the proposal would go on next year's ballot because it seeks to change the state constitution. A proposed constitutional amendment would make county school board members voluntary employees. Supporters say nixing their paychecks would take the politics out of decision-making. Opponents say the move would impact diversity on school boards. And finally, lawmakers are concerned about the recovery of space vehicles. That includes space capsules, launch vehicles, and parachutes. A proposal would require people who find space vehicles and parts to report them to law enforcement. That's some of what's happening tomorrow at the Capitol. I'm Gina Jordan.
You're listening to Capitol Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally tonight, Manatee County is fairly far removed from Tallahassee, but what happened there in recent days has state officials concerned as well as searching for a solution. HRK Holdings, the owner of the abandoned phosphate mine, spent months warning Manatee commissioners and state officials of impending disaster at the Piney Point site. WMNF's Daniel Figueroa IV reports despite the pleas for help, Florida officials said HRK will be on the hook for a narrowly avoided catastrophe at the now-shuttered mine's holding pond.
Florida DEP head Noah Valenstein said a legal team in Tallahassee is working just as hard as crews on the ground at Piney Point cleaning the spill.
We also have a team of attorneys back at Tallahassee that are making sure they take advantage of all the information we're collecting to then put together a case to hold HRK fully accountable.
State and local officials were able to avoid complete catastrophe at Piney Point. Model simulations originally predicted the nearly 800 million gallons of contaminated water on the site could have collapsed stacks of radioactive phosphogypsum, thus sending the waste and water rushing into the county and Tampa Bay as a 20-foot wave. Instead, the DEP said 215 million gallons of salt water and processed water contaminated with phosphorus, nitrogen, and other pollutants was purposefully drained into Port Manatee and Tampa Bay. The worst was avoided, but excess nutrients in the discharged water can harm plant and marine life and fuel dangerous red tide and algal blooms. The DEP said water sampling in the area already shows elevated levels of nutrients with algae visible in the water column. About 500 million gallons of water with higher concentrations of pollutants still sit at Piney Point. Tuesday, Governor Ron DeSantis ordered it closed.
We want this to be the last chapter of the Piney Point story. So today I'm directing the Department of Environmental Protection to create a plan to close Piney Point.
Last week, Florida's Senate approved $3 million for cleanup and closure efforts. Monday, DeSantis announced another $15.4 million to help pretreat and clean the water. Senate President Wilton Simpson said another $100 million would be freed this year for the effort.
The object would be to come back next year and have a fully funded plan.
DeSantis praised DEP's swift response, and DEP in turn thanked DeSantis for quickly declaring a state of emergency. Both labeled HRK as a bad actor and said it'd be held responsible. But disaster at Piney Point was both preventable and predictable. HRK Holdings has owned the Piney Point land for about a decade, but never did any processing there. The massive gyp stacks contain waste built up by the Mulberry Corporation between 1966 and 2001. The site has been plagued with issues for years. Spills and issues with liners separating the water from the radioactive stacks were well known. And since at least September, site manager Jeff Barath warned that disaster loomed at Piney Point. The ponds filled with millions of gallons of water could hold no more. Here's Barath at a September County Commission meeting.
We are quickly running out of processed water capacity inside of the Piney Point facility.
And again in February, when the stacks were even more full.
Based on our current water volumes, action is needed. Now.
DEP program manager John Coates attended the September meeting and supported a plan to pump 50,000 gallons of water a day into Manatee County's water treatment plant. The plan was adopted earlier this year, but would take about 50 years to empty the ponds at that rate. In 2013, the Manatee Commission nixed a plan to empty ponds into a deep injection well. At a meeting last week, the plan for a deep injection well received unanimous support. County Administrator Scott Hopes said it's now the best option.
This is, in my opinion, the most effective way and the most timely way to approach this.
In a call with WMNF Tuesday, Barath said he couldn't comment on any potential lawsuits, but is just happy to finally have some help. I'm Daniel Figueroa IV.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Valerie Crowder, Robbie Gaffney, Blaise Ganey, Lynn Hatter, Gina Jordan, and Regan McCarthy. Thanks also to Daniel Figueroa IV. Technical assistance for Capitol Report comes from Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Please join us every evening at this time throughout the 2021 Florida lawmaking session for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee. For more information about Capitol Report and to hear previous episodes, visit WFSU.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: a grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley, supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Florida State University, ranked in the top 20 among national public universities in the latest U.S. News & World Report. FSU specialty license plates support scholarships for deserving students. More on FSU specialty plates is at fsu.edu/mytag. Rambana & Ritchie, immigration attorneys concentrating on complex immigration across the nation from Florida's capital and their mobile office. Self-sponsored green cards, I-9 compliance, and deportation defense. Rambana and Ritchie, on the web at rambana.com. And from the Florida AFL-CIO, representing over 1 million union members, retirees, and their families, committed to building a better future for all Floridians by promoting healthy communities, economic justice, and dignity in the workplace. Online at flafl-cio.org.